Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, and supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your callers from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us Dr. Henry Nyman, and he is into all sorts of genetics and microbiology, and he has his own company. Is it Recombinetics? What's the title? What's the name of the company?
It's actually Recombinomics.
Recombinomics, okay. And he's been doing some fascinating work analyzing the genetic sequences of the new avian flu, and of course whether or not this is really going to, whether Tamiflu, which is the drug that is being touted as a means of treatment, really is effective. So I'm going to let Dr. Nyman just sort of introduce himself and tell you a little bit about his background.
Okay, thanks, Stan. I formed a company called Recombinomics, and it was really designed to study how viruses emerge and evolve. And the study focuses on the genetic sequences and looks at how viruses change genes over time. And been spending a lot of time focusing on the influenza virus. My background, my PhD was actually in biochemistry. And my thesis was on retroviruses. These are viruses that cause tumors in animals. So I had a background in infectious diseases and actually developed monoclonal antibodies, and one of the more popular ones is actually against influenza. And I became interested more in the infectious disease area when I was at Harvard, and the SARS outbreak kind of caught the imagination of a lot of scientists as to exactly what was going on with this new emerging virus, and that was in 2003. And then after looking at how the SARS coronavirus was evolving, I started looking at the influenza virus, and there's a large database of genetic information that goes all the way back to 1902. And influenza is a concern because there have been three pandemics in the last decade. The big one was in 1918, and that could have killed up to 50 million people worldwide. Then there was another one in 1957, and the third one was in 1968. So it's been a little while since the last one appeared. One thing that is striking about each of these pandemics is the virus that causes the pandemic is kind of new to humans. And the viruses are really cataloged to a degree based on two of their eight genes. It's the H gene, which is called hemagglutinin, and the N gene, which is called neuraminidase. The H gets the virus into a cell, the N gets the virus out of a cell. And the two proteins are really designated based upon serological reactivity. So there's 16 H's and 9 N's.
And of course, with me here now, the one they're talking about is something called H5N1, which is this sort of a unique composition? Is this different than we've seen before?
Yes, H5N1 was first identified in Scotland in a chicken in 1959, and the first time it showed up in Asia was in a Guangdong goose in 1996.
Pull that off. We're going to be back here in just a moment, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. Today our guest is Dr. Henry Nyman, and he is a biochemist who's been very interested in the molecular structure of the viruses and their evolution. He has a corporation called Recombinonics, and we're talking about what we know about the H5N1 virus, which is the one now, the avian flu virus, and apparently this is a fairly new virus. Would you just mention once again, because we have some new listeners right now, when this virus first appeared?
Okay, the H5N1 was first isolated in 1959, or that's when it traces back. It was from a chicken in Scotland, and then the first isolate in Asia came from a goose in Guangdong province, actually the same province where SARS arose, and that was in 1996. Just to give a little background, the viruses are pretty much characterized, cataloged, based on these two surface proteins, which most animals generate an immune response to. So those are the two that are targeted the most, and they're basically numbered sequentially when a new isolate comes along that doesn't match any of the existing ones. It gets a new number. That actually happened just a few months ago. There were 15 H's, and then there were isolates from Europe, actually from the Netherlands, and these were migrating birds also, and they didn't react with any of the 15 H's, and so they became H16. And then the same sequence of events is for the N, so there's 9 N. So there's really 144 theoretical combinations of H and N. But there aren't that many in humans. The different combinations are primarily found in migratory birds. In humans, there's really only 3 H's and 2 N's that have been found in the past.
Now, is there some sort of selectivity? In other words, is there a species barrier that prevents these avian viruses from crossing over into the human species?
Well, there usually is, and it's when this barrier is breached is when the pandemics arise. So the first pandemic in 1918 was H1N1, and then in 1957, H2 acquired the ability to infect humans, and there was a pandemic. It was an H2N2, and then in 1968 there was another breach with H3, and the virus that infected humans was H3N2. Now H3N2 is still around, as is H1N1. H2N2 is pretty much drifted away.
All right, our guest is Dr. Henry Nyman. We're talking about the background of the numbering of these surface proteins on the virus. And, of course, they label them for the two various components. One is the H component, one is the N component. And Dr. Nyman was saying that the initial one that they had back in 1918 was an H1N1, and then the one that we had in 1957 was an H2N2. And then, of course, seeing the sequences, most of them will not cross the species barrier. This is what you're concerned about. If they can go from the birds or the other animals that are infected into human beings. So why do we think that this is really going to get this one that they have, in Asia today, has the ability to infect humans? There have been, only about 100 known cases of the disease so far?
Correct. So far there have been about 117, and half of them have died. The reason H5 is looking like it's going to cause the next pandemic is because first the requirement is that it's a new H, that people have antibodies to H1, H2, and H3. So in general, there's flu that arises every year, but it doesn't get into the pandemic form where people don't really have a good immune system to attack it. They're basically called immunologically naive. And that's what's happened to these 117 people or so. They were infected with H5N1. They didn't have a good set of antibodies to combat that, and the virus is quite aggressive and actually resulted in the deaths of half of them. Now, the history of H5N1 in humans really started right after it showed up in Asia. It showed up in 1996. The next year, there was a small outbreak in 1997 in Hong Kong. There were 18 people that were infected, and six of them died. Hong Kong took a very aggressive stance. They basically killed all the birds in Hong Kong. There were about 1.5 million of them. They were all culled, and then H5N1 was seen in birds, but it didn't show up in humans again until 2003. And then it was all again small. It was just a family that had gone on vacation to Fujian province in China. They were from Hong Kong. The girl became ill in China and actually died in China. The father and son returned to Hong Kong, and the father died, the son survived, and the H5N1 virus was isolated from the two that returned to Hong Kong. And then it really exploded in 2004. In 2004, H5N1 really spread throughout Asia. So it was found in South Korea, in Japan, in many provinces in China, in Indonesia, and then in Vietnam and Thailand. And in Vietnam and Thailand, it not only showed up in the birds, but it also showed up in people. And that's where the bulk of the people that had been affected were in either Vietnam or Thailand in 2004. And then there was a lot of culling again. There were close to 150 million birds that were culled. And in spite of that aggressive culling, the virus came back again in 2005. And in 2005, it infected people in North and South Vietnam, as well as Cambodia, and more recently, Indonesia. And the virus changed a little bit in 2005 as far as its case fatality rate. In northern Vietnam, the fatality rate actually went down. In 2004, it was at 70%. So 70% of the people that were infected and were diagnosed as being infected went in the hospital, and only 30% of them came out of the hospital. This year, it kind of segregated out. In the north, the number that died fell to about 5%, 5 to 10%. But the number that died in the south actually went up, and virtually 100% have died in the south. The same thing is with Cambodia and Indonesia, that all of the official cases that were confirmed have died. So in the south, the fatality rate's at 100%. In the north, it's about 5%. Now, just to put those numbers in perspective, in the pandemic in 1918 that killed 50 million people, the case fatality rate then was only around 2.5%. So even a 5% in northern Vietnam is still a figure that would create major problems if the virus was able to transmit efficiently from human to human.
But, of course, will it at this stage go efficiently from human to humans? Do we have any idea?
Well, we have some ideas. I mean, one of the ideas comes out of North Vietnam, because in North Vietnam, when the fatality rate went down, the transmissibility went up. And so these what are called familial clusters. These are people within the same family that essentially infect each other. And usually there's a first case, which is an index case, and then generally 5 to 10 days later, the person that takes care of the index case comes down with avian influenza. And in many cases, especially in 2004, the index case, there were no samples collected, but there were samples collected from the second and third case in the family, and those were tested positive for H5N1. But those clusters were fairly small. They involved 2 to 4 people in a family. In 2005, the cluster started to get a little bit bigger, where there would be there was one cluster where it was a brother and sister were infected, and the grandfather had antibodies. The nurse that took care of the brother became infected, and then even another nurse became infected, although she developed symptoms. She wasn't confirmed to be positive. But you had a little cluster there. There was a family of 5. The same thing happened. In that case, they all developed symptoms the same day. They all went in the hospital. They were all H5N1 positive, but they actually all survived. And that's what's changed somewhat in northern Vietnam, is that the survival is better, but the transmission is higher. So the cluster started to get a little larger. There's a little bit of controversy in northern Vietnam because what had happened is the investigators had seen these clusters getting bigger. There were clusters of clusters. There were certain provinces that seemed to have a lot of cases, the lion's share of the cases. And so they began collecting serum samples from contacts of the people that were infected. And they ran tests on those serum samples, and they were positive. But the people that were positive had milder symptoms, and the WHO tested some more, and one lab came up and said, well, they can't repeat the positive. So right now, those are kind of in a question mark, because there's some data that says the contacts are positive, some data that says they couldn't reproduce it, and so there's still more tests going on. But there's a good chance that usually in science, if you test and one is positive and one is negative, usually the positive is right, because it's a lot harder to get a false positive than a false negative. There's a lot of ways that you can get a false negative, and the positives are with contact. So, I mean, that's who is positive. So if there's human-to-human transmission, the people that you'd expect to be positive are the ones that are positive.
Well, now as the birds are beginning to migrate from Asia over into the Central Asia from around Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan and all those countries, are there any evidence of any human transmissions? What's happening to the migratory birds? Are they dying or are they surviving fine?
Well, there's a little bit of each, and what's going on with the migratory birds is a pretty straightforward story. So the migratory birds are creating one story, and what they're doing to associated people is kind of a little bit unknown still. I mean, it started back in May. In May, there were barheaded geese that basically began to die at a nature reserve in Qinghai Province, which is in central, north and south is central, and is more to the west side of China. And this is a large inland saltwater lake that's very popular with migratory birds. And it actually is at the intersection of two flyways. One is the eastern flyway, which covers most of eastern Asia, and the other is the north central, which goes all the way down into India and all the way up to Siberia. And as a result, you can get birds from most of Asia showing up at Qinghai Lake. And these early arrivals were barheaded geese, which usually come from northern India. The geese are pretty remarkable. They can fly 1,000 miles in a given day, so they can start in northern India and end up at Qinghai Lake within 24 hours. And the early arrivals at the beginning of May started to die. And China took note of that and put out a news story, and they initially said that they died, but they weren't due to H5N1. And then the numbers that died, originally it was only 178, the numbers continued to go up. They did some testing and found out that indeed they were H5N1 positive. And they filed a report on May 21st saying there were 519 birds. They were H5N1 positive. They covered five different species, and most of them were these barheaded geese. Then there was some more news that came out from a kind of an alternate news source. This is a group in China that basically had student reporters on the scene, which appeared to be getting some government documents, and they were putting that information out. And they indicated that there were a lot more birds dying than China was admitting, and that there were people that were dying. And I don't know if there's a break coming up.
I'm afraid that there is. But we're going to, I don't run the program, or the computer runs the program. We'll be back in just a minute with Dr. Henry Nyman, and you'll find this a fascinating discussion as we begin to explore what's really going on behind the scenes, whether there's a problem, whether this is a scare statistics or a scare campaign, or whether there really is a threat to the people of this country and certainly of Asia.
Our four-tape set on the JFK assassination includes an interview with Lee Harvey Oswald. Of course, it's not an interview that I did, but it is an interview, and you'll actually hear Lee Harvey Oswald talking before the time of the assassination, a two-hour interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who was the liaison between the Pentagon and the CIA at the time of the assassination of the American president, and then, of course, my overall analysis of the reasons why President Kennedy was assassinated. There's so much information that has not been put out, and if you listen to this four-tape set, you will begin to understand that there are forces at work behind the scenes which have been able to confuse the American people about the reality of the murder of an American president. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, that's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and ask for the JFK assassination tapes.
This is health journalist Bill Sardi. In November of 1991, the 60 Minutes television show first reported on the French paradox, the fact the French violate every dietary rule for good health, eat a diet rich in fats and calories, and yet exhibit far better cardiovascular health than North Americans. Over a decade later, we know that molecules called polyphenols are responsible for the health benefits in red wine. But those molecules only remain stable in a sealed bottle of red wine. Longevinix is the first dietary supplement to stabilize red wine molecules in a sealed capsule, just like a corked bottle of red wine, providing red wine polyphenols without the calories, alcohol, and sulfite preservatives. One Longevinix capsule is equivalent in polyphenols to drinking 5 glasses of red wine. Call 866-405-4000 today to order Longevinix. It's a revolutionary dietary supplement. 866-405-4000.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Thierry. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Hi, this is Joyce Riley, and most of you now know why so many people agree that Miracle 2 soap really is a miracle. Miracle 2 products are now being used by farmers and ranchers to increase their yield. Mechanics and machinists use it in their shops. Chiropractors and physicians are using Miracle 2, and the uses are simply too numerous to mention. Dr. Stan and the folks at Radio Liberty knew right away that the listeners would benefit tremendously by using Miracle 2 products. You can enjoy the benefits of Miracle 2 and help Radio Liberty continue to broadcast Dr. Stan's message by calling 800-544-8927 to order your Miracle 2 today. After you've tried Miracle 2 around the house, you'll probably do just what so many others have done. Get rid of all those toxic cleaners and chemicals under your sink. Call Radio Liberty and order your Miracle 2 today. 800-544-8927.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, our guest this afternoon, Dr. Henry Nyman, and we're talking about what's really going on. So Dr. Nyman was saying that they were beginning to get some reports out of China from more or less an underground group that was trying to get word out that the Chinese government was not telling the truth and that the epidemic was really far more serious in China than we were being told. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. The group was called Boxun.com, B-O-X-U-N. .com. They're also in English as Abundant News. This group actually was involved with getting the word out on SARS. So when SARS started in China, it was pretty much covered up and word did not leak out. They started leaking the word out through a newsletter, an infectious disease newsletter called ProMed. And so when they put out a story that that six tourists in Qinghai Lake had actually died, that got a lot of attention focused on exactly what was going on in Qinghai Lake. And they came out with a few different stories. One was that the number of birds that had died was really 8,000. It wasn't just five species. It was 13 species. And when that story came out, China actually came out with a news conference literally the next day, and they did up their numbers. They said that they had over 1,000 that had died, and that the number of birds dying was unprecedented. But then the Baxin organization came out with reports of the humans, and the numbers kept climbing. First there were six tourists, and there were 11 healthcare workers, and it went up to 121 people had died. Now, China maintained that the people were, that there were no human casualties, and that essentially was limited to birds. Well, this got the attention of the World Health Organization, and they put in a request to China to come and see how things were going at Qinghai Lake. In the meantime, there was two more outbreaks, and they were in the neighboring province of Xinjiang, and one of them was in the town of Tacheng, and the same thing was happening there, except this time it was with domestic poultry, and geese were dying. And usually H5N1 doesn't kill geese, so the fact that geese were dying kind of implicated the migratory birds again. And the geese did test positive for H5N1. And then the Tacheng one was really right on the border with Kazakhstan. And it was just 100 miles south of the border with Russia and Mongolia. So there was concern that the birds were actually carrying the H5N1, and they were distributing it, and right at that time, which was at the beginning of June, it was still in China, but there was the danger that it was going to spread into Kazakhstan, Russia, and Mongolia. And none of those three countries had ever recorded this Asian version of H5N1. So it was basically going to be moving into new territory. So WHO wanted to come and take a look. And initially, China resisted and delayed. It took about 3 weeks to get permission to go to Qinghai Lake. And in the meantime, there were reports that there were pneumonia cases in Tacheng. And the pneumonia cases resulted in the hospital setting up an isolation ward, and the story that came out was that there were bacterial infections. And bacterial pneumonia generally isn't that severe, and it's not that contagious. It would be unusual to set up an isolation ward for patients and healthcare workers for bacterial pneumonia. So there was suspicion that there were pneumonia cases from the H5N1. And WHO, once they had permission to go to Qinghai Lake, they asked to go to Tacheng, and that permission was not granted. So they did go to Qinghai Lake, and found out that, much to their surprise, even though China had said that the outbreak was unprecedented, they had really only tested 12 birds, and the 12 birds were positive for H5N1. So it was a little bit surprising that that was the limit of at least the acknowledged number of tests that were done.
And but, of course, how many birds had actually died? Did the World Health Organization determine that?
Yes, the World Health Organization said there were over 5,000 birds that had died.
All right, so the Chinese government, for some reason or other, is not being really forthright. Do you think it's because they're afraid of tourism, or are they covering up something else?
They're probably covering up something else. They basically, you can get a lot of information from the sequences, and if they had a lot more virus isolated, they would have to reveal a lot more sequence, and the sequence kind of tells the story on exactly what's going on, and they do not seem to want to do that.
All right, well, when we get back, maybe we can begin to explore what really is going on. And then, of course, these birds are going to be flying over, my understanding is to, will they be going over to Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan, or will they stop where they are?
No, they'll keep on going, and after the break, their path is littered with dead birds.
Hold up.
there's any one tape that you should hear, it's my talk on geopolitics, an untold story that is vitally important if America is to survive as a free nation. It goes into the background of the forces that have created the wars of the 20th century, the Boer War, the First World War, the Second World War, Korea, Vietnam. We go into the ideological and the spiritual battle behind the forces that have moved America from crisis to crisis and are currently undermining the very fabric of our society. That number again, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and the tape, Geopolitics. It is vitally important that you help us to get this message out across America, because without knowledge, my people perish. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR for copies of my talk on geopolitics.
Well, it starts with a sound education. VHM provides for that cornerstone of your child's future with a quality education founded on biblical principles. Our school sets high academic goals while developing moral standards. From preschool through eighth grade, your child is taught by experienced and credentialed teachers in all subjects, including our dynamic music program and state-of-the-art computer classes. Proverbs 22:6 says, "Train up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it." For over 50 years, VHM Christian School has provided peace of mind to parents knowing their children are receiving an excellent education in a loving environment. VHM is located at 427 Capitola Road Extension in Santa Cruz. Won't you call us today at 475-4762? That's VHM Christian School at 475-4762. Doesn't your child deserve a chance to try VHM? If you're looking...
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and we certainly want to mention that we do have a number of very important books on health and how to increase your immunity. One of those books I would suggest would be the book Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life, a book put out by our good friend Dr. Russell Blaylock, who is a retired neurosurgeon. I've known him for 20 years. And Dr. Russell Blaylock has tremendous amount of information there. So that's Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. And then we have a four-tape set with Dr. Blaylock called Life-Saving Secrets. That's Life-Saving Secrets. And they're both available by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And you must realize that the person primarily responsible for your health is you. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Dr. Henry Nyman. Dr. Nyman, please pick up the story there. We were talking about what is going on in China, the fact that the Chinese government is not being forthright as far as certainly the number of birds have died, and as far as the number of people have died. And they said that these people were having pneumonia. What was this about the pig or the swine flu that's over there, supposedly some sort of a bacterial pneumonia that's killed a number of people? What do we know about that?
Well, the situation is actually in another neighboring province. It's right next to Qinghai. It's Sichuan province, and in Sichuan province, bacteria is being invoked to explain the phenomenon, but it doesn't really quite add up. And in that instance, these cases started with farmers who had contact with pigs. The pigs started to get sick and die. The farmers were involved with mostly slaughtering the pigs. And some of the farmers who subsequently died did have evidence of a bacteria that's commonly found. It's a streptococcus that's commonly found in pigs. The reason the streptococcus is not high on the list of suspect agents is that it is common in the pigs. A lot of pigs actually carry the virus without any symptoms, but it ends up causing a problem when the pigs are either stressed or they are infected with something else. And so the question is whether that's what's going on here. The number of cases grew very dramatically. It covered most of Sichuan province. Sichuan province is known for their pig farms, and they do produce a large number of pigs in China. but it spread very rapidly. The case fatality rate initially was in the 70-80% range.
Now, was that for pigs or for humans?
That was actually for the humans.
All right.
And so that's the other aspect, is the bacteria generally, there were only 100 cases worldwide reported of this bacteria causing any problems in humans. And most of the humans certainly didn't develop into getting a fatal disease. In this case, the humans were dying at a high percentage. I think the current percentage is closer to the upper 40%. So you've got almost half of the people that are diagnosed with this die before they leave the hospital. You only have a few more discharged than you have died right now.
And will the World Health Organization, have they been allowed to go in and check this story out, or are they being kept away from it?
No, that's another problem. It's the same thing where the World Health Organization is having trouble getting in to see it, and they don't really believe it. They have the same concerns that I just mentioned, that it seems that the case fatality rate is too high. It's not really believable that this is all being caused by a bacteria. They've asked for samples, haven't been able to get samples, and haven't been able to go in and see what's going on. And so they call for further investigations because they are assuming there's another agent. And the other agent, there's a couple different, you know, prime possibilities. One, of course, is that it is H5N1 because it is next to Qinghai Lake. And the virus is known to infect pigs, and it's also known to create a number of different symptoms. The symptoms in the people actually resembles, they develop cyanosis, so their whole body turns dark. And that was one of the hallmarks of the 1918 pandemic, is that there was many patients that had bleeding under the skin, and that they could literally see the body turn dark, you know, in a matter of hours. And that's the exact same description that's coming out for these patients. So one possibility is that indeed they do have H5N1. And that is why they're dying, and that's why China would not want that information out, because if they were dying from H5N1, then it would kind of lend credence to the Qinghai Lake, and it would say that there's a major pandemic in China right now. The other possibility is this Boxing organization has documented Ebola being in China, and that's a big surprise because so far Ebola has not been reported outside of Africa. And their reports are that there are several different strains of Ebola, including one that was isolated in Shenzhen province, and that that same strain of Ebola is being isolated from these patients, and that it is actually changing, is recombining. It's mixing its genetic information with another virus. And interestingly enough, there is a small region within the genes of H5N1 and Ebola that are identical. So it is conceivable that there is recombination between those two.
All right, well, now then, where do we stand as far as the birds? Have the birds then gone beyond the Chinese lake over into the Central Asia?
Right. So basically what happens with the birds, the migratory birds are known to some nest and rest in Qinghai Lake, and then they go on to southern Siberia to spend the summer. And the report started to come out of Siberia, this Chaney Lake, which is another lake reserve, nature reserve. The story started to emerge from there about 2 or 3 weeks ago, that again geese were dying, and it looked like it was happening because of migratory birds. And they were tested, and initially they were just called H5 positive. And then in neighboring Kazakhstan, the same thing happened where geese were dying, and they were H5 positive. And then just about a week ago, there were reports of birds dying in Mongolia, and they've been characterized as being positive for bird flu, but they haven't determined whether they're H5 or not. But the investigation has gone the furthest on the bird side in Russia. The United States actually has a surveillance program up there. The National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases has a program through St. Jude Hospital and a group called Vector Laboratories up in Novosibirsk. And they have found H5 in the past, but the H5 in the past has not been the Asian version. It's been a European version. It's not been this highly pathogenic type. And so they have isolated nine different isolates. They have nine different sources where they've got virus to grow. And they've done some sequencing on it, and they found that indeed it is H5N1, and that it is related to the virus out of Vietnam, which is the one that is causing the human deaths. And they say that it's like the Vietnam version, but it's not quite the same. Now, before this happened, sequences did come out from the isolates at King High Lake. That was published in two very highly prestigious journals. One was in Science, and that was done by a group out of Beijing. And the other was in Nature, and that was a group out of Hong Kong and Shantou. The group out of Hong Kong and Shantou actually sequenced all 12 of those isolates from all 12 of those birds. And China did four of them. And the results were similar in both groups, and they showed that all of the birds at Qinghai Lake had a very similar virus, an H5N1 that was related to Vietnam, but it was slightly different. The Nature article described eight more H5N1s from eastern China, and that was a problem for China because H5N1's a reportable disease, and they had not reported any cases in 2005 before Qinghai Lake. And so this group had the virus, they had the sequence, there was no doubt it was H5N1, and so China was kind of caught with revealing that these viruses exist, and they responded by closing the labs. So they ended up shutting down the lab in Shantou, said that it didn't meet their safety standards, and said that, you know, if there's any sequencing going to be done, we'll do it, and just send it to our Harbin facility, and we'll handle all the data.
Sounds very suspicious to me.
Yes, it was very suspicious that they basically want to control the information. They put all kind of restrictions on sharing data and samples with other scientists, and they basically just shut off the information.
Well, now, what about up in Russia and Kazakhstan and Mongolia? Are there any people being involved, or is it just primarily in the birds?
Well, that's what the problem is. The birds just started, and there are reports. And the first reports actually started coming out of Kazakhstan. And the first one sounded pretty definitive. It was a poultry worker who had developed double pneumonia. And he actually worked just across the border from Cheney Lake. And there were birds that were infected there. Then the story kind of changed a little bit with him. And it was like, well, he developed symptoms before the birds did, which didn't really mean too much because the birds were in Tacheng back in the beginning of June, so there certainly was room for virus to arrive well before they were being reported in Kazakhstan. And then they said, well, he didn't have bird flu, he just had double pneumonia. But they never really said what the double pneumonia was from, and bird flu causes double pneumonia. So he's still kind of sitting there without knowing exactly what was causing the double pneumonia. Then there was another family nearby. It had developed symptoms, family of four, and they had just eaten goose meat, and geese are where the virus is. And so they were a little bit suspect. And then there was another group of 15 people that had eaten chicken at a dining hall, and they all developed symptoms. So there's 20 people in Kazakhstan that are still in they've got the symptoms, but they haven't really said what etiological agent is causing those symptoms. So they're kind of in a question mark stand. The same type of thing is happening in Russia. In Russia, the bird flu is spread. It's moved through, I believe, seven different provinces now, at least with birds dying. It's been confirmed in, I believe, three. They've identified H5N1. Two they've determined as bird flu, but they don't have a type on it. And they've actually, in the most detailed portion, they've kind of come up with an explanation as to how this has happened by looking at the birds. And when they looked at the birds, they found that in some of the villages, the birds were dead, they were positive for virus, and they were positive for antibody. In others, the birds were alive. It's not even clear how sick they were, but they were positive for the virus and positive for the antibodies. And the third group was just positive for the antibodies. So the middle group is the group that's most interesting, because that's indicating that some of these birds are infected with the virus, but they're not sick. And that's how the virus is moving, is through asymptomatic infections, which is exactly what happened in Vietnam and Thailand. There were a lot of waterfowl that basically had the virus. And there was actually an experiment that was done where the virus that killed people was experimentally used to infect ducks. And the ducks didn't get sick. The ducks grew the virus to very high levels. They excreted the virus. And the virus that was excreted was at a very high concentration and very stable. And so that's what the problem is. The asymptomatic birds have the virus. They don't die. They transport the virus. And then they excrete the virus, which then contaminates other birds and, in some cases, people. So that's what was found in Novosibirsk. And the virus basically has got all the way to Kurgan, which is just a few hundred miles from the Ural Mountains. So the virus is approaching Europe right now. And it's H5N1. And today, Russia kind of declared it as stage 2. Stage 2 means that, A, they've got a virus, and, B, that it's likely to infect humans. And it's not really clear exactly why they called it stage 2, whether it's just because it's H5N1 or whether they do have patients with symptoms. So they're a little bit on hold. But then the third country is Mongolia. And Mongolia announced several days ago that they had geese dying also, swans and geese, and that they also attributed it to migratory birds, as did the other two countries. Both Russia and Kazakhstan really said that all of this started as the birds started to leave their nesting areas because it's starting to get cold up there and they're moving to warmer climates. And the story that kind of came out just before the broadcast was that there are 100 people in Mongolia that have been quarantined. And that's a little bit unusual. Usually what happens is if people are exposed to the birds, they are monitored and they're tested, but they're not quarantined. So this story of 100 people being quarantined by one of the lakes where there have been 86 birds that have been identified, and they are definitely bird flu positive. They haven't confirmed it's H5, but it's almost certainly H5 just because of the location and because of the fact that the geese are dying, and it's now spreading in Mongolia. And so there have been two more locations, one in central Mongolia and one in southern Mongolia. So the ones in southern Mongolia are birds essentially heading back south and getting ready to go back into China. And that's what the concern is that there are reports of humans associated with these. The human cases have not been confirmed yet, but the H5N1 is in these three countries for the first time, and it's moving. And now that it's getting cool in Siberia, those birds are going to move to warmer climates. And so some of the birds are going to leave Siberia, some of the birds are going to leave Qinghai Lake, which is at a very high altitude, so there's snow on the ground there already also. So even though it's further south than Siberia, it is the weather is changing and the birds are starting to leave. And because of the fact that these flyways intersect in this region, the birds that are leaving really cover all of Asia and essentially all of Europe. So what you have now is you've got one group that's heading west and approaching Europe, and they're in Russia and Kazakhstan right now. And then you have another group that's going in the other direction. They're leaving and heading east, and they're heading southeast. So they're getting ready to enter China and go back down to Vietnam and Thailand. And the problem is that the H5N1 is endemic down there, so there's other birds that are down there that don't migrate, including a lot of the domestic poultry and the ducks. And they have H5N1. And there's two different versions of it in Vietnam, and you're going to have these new ones coming in. And the way the virus changes is you get two viruses that infect the same bird. And the concern is that now a new set of sequences are going to be flying in. They're going to recombine. They're going to create new genes. And you're going to get viruses that come out that are efficiently transmitted like they are in northern Vietnam, or infect a pig and get even more efficient and still have this high type of lethality rate.
Well, we're going to have to take a quick break. When I get back, I really wanted to talk a little bit about your work on Tamiflu, because I know you've done some experiments on that, and I think it's important to know if there is any effective treatment. Tamiflu seems to be the only antibiotic that really is effective. Amantadine might have been, but if they've been used it so extensively over in China, apparently many of the versions of this virus now are amantadine resistant. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty.
Now, most people would laugh at the idea that there is or has been a secret society. I wanted to tell you about a tape we have. It's a talk I gave before the Concerned Women of America some years ago, and it basically goes back into the background behind the secret society, which was formed in England and eventually came to America and came to be known as the Council on Foreign Relations. It goes into the background of Cecil Rhodes. And how does that secret society that he created impact on you today? If you read the works of Professor Carol Quigley, who was Bill Clinton's mentor, you'll understand that Professor Quigley is probably one of the leading experts today on history, but also a man who had the courage to speak out. You need to get the four-tape set, The Secret Government, to understand what Professor Quigley taught Bill Clinton. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is under attack today.
Well, Dr. Nyman, what about the effectiveness of Tamiflu? You've done some experiments with that, haven't you, as well?
Well, actually, the Tamiflu, I've analyzed the data. There's been published data on the Tamiflu.
All right.
And, that's an unfortunate situation. What's happening is the virus is changing, and the media is not really keeping up with the changes, and the information is not getting conveyed to decision makers, and there's a lot of misconceptions on the Tamiflu and on the vaccine and on amantadine and amantadine.
All right, fine. Well, that's why we've come to you. What can you tell us about the Tamiflu, about the amantadine, about the vaccine?
Okay. The human cases, as we said earlier, really started in Vietnam and Thailand. And in Vietnam and Thailand, there is amantadine resistance. The amantadine basically attacks a protein called M2, and in the M2 there are known positions that change and create resistance. And in fact, the isolates in Vietnam and Thailand really have two mutations. So they're basically resistant to amantadine at two different positions. And so that drug is really not going to work on any virus that comes out of Vietnam and Thailand. There are actually sequences that just came out a few days ago out of Thailand from 2004, and there were 38 of them, and all 38 of them were resistant. So as far as Vietnam and Thailand is concerned, the only antiviral that's available in quantity is Tamiflu. Now, the problem with the Tamiflu is there was just a study that was published on how well Tamiflu worked in mice. And the problem is that Tamiflu attacks the virus itself. It attacks the N. And it's been FDA approved for both N1 and N2. But it works a lot better against N2, which is like the human H3N2.
Hold that thought right there for a moment. Okay. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Dr. Nyman was saying that the amantadine, which is the traditional antibiotic, really doesn't seem to be going to work against the kinds that are over in Vietnam and the surrounding areas. And then we were talking about the Tamiflu and whether this antibiotic would work. And so why don't you pick up the story there?
Okay. Well, the Tamiflu was just tested in an experiment. There have been some test tube experiments that indicated the Tamiflu worked a lot better on N2 than N1, and it didn't work that well on H5N1. Then there were mouse studies that were done to see just how well Tamiflu would work, and it was actually using one of the viruses from Vietnam. And those experiments indicated that Tamiflu really did not work that well, that it did work if you used it at a high enough concentration. The problem is the concentration that was used in the mice were 10 times the concentrations as FDA approved. Now, there may be some differences between mice and humans, and mice might not be able to metabolize it quite as effectively, but it was using a massive dose of Tamiflu. And even when using the massive dose, and even starting the Tamiflu before the mice were infected, half of the mice were dying when they were using a treatment protocol. That essentially after 5 days, 50% of the mice still died. So that raised some serious questions as to how effective Tamiflu was and at what levels it had to be used at. And if indeed it needs to be used at 5 or 10 times the levels that are approved, then the shortage of Tamiflu will become much more acute. And there's a major shortage. Countries are trying to stockpile it. Most of them talk about how much they've ordered versus how much they actually have on hand. Great Britain was a good example of that. Great Britain said they were going to get enough Tamiflu to protect a quarter of their population. And then when it came down to, well, how much do you have on hand, they only had 100,000 courses. And if you really need five times the amount, they really only have enough to treat 20,000 people. And that's only good for 10 days because the antiviral only works while you're taking it. And one course is really good for one pill a day for 10 days. And so then they made the decision that they're not going to use it prophylactically. They're not going to use it to prevent the disease. They're just going to use it to treat. And that's you know, not really sitting well with people who thought they were going to be protected, the first responders who have to go and you know, pick up people that are ill, and the police and the fire department, the emergency medical, all of those people, and the doctors and nurses all assumed that if they were going to be put at risk, they were going to have access to Tamiflu, and now it turns out they're not going to have access. So there's a major problem with the supply of Tamiflu, and many countries, including the United States, have backordered. The United States has about 2.5 million courses, but that's based on basically a pill a day for 10 days, and that's, you know, if you wanted to protect somebody for 60 days, even just using the FDA-approved dose is going to require 6 courses. And if you look at the mouse data, it's like you have to use 5 times that amount, so you're going to be using 30 courses per person, and you start dividing 2.5 million by 30, and you find out you really only have enough for 100,000 people in a country of 300 million. So it doesn't cover the first responders.
Oh, you know, we're out of time. I wish we could go on. I hope we can get you back on here again sometime real soon. But is there any solution at all right at the present time other than to pray this thing does not break out?
Well, one of the silver linings is that the migratory bird version is susceptible to amantadine. So amantadine should be able to work, even though resistance can develop. It should be able to work for the birds that are heading towards Europe and probably be spreading throughout Asia. But the vaccine looks like it needs a lot of work, so there really isn't a vaccine, which is more of a long-term solution.
Well, we're out of time, but thank you so very much, and I will be talking to you off the air and hope we can get you back again sometime when we don't have to. I cut you short. God bless. Thanks so much for being with us.
Okay, good talking.
Bye-bye. All right, that was Dr. Henry Nyman. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll talk to you later. Pray for America and pray for revival.